Well, Justin Mobley from our church is about eighth grade, I think, and he was in my office a couple of weeks ago, just kind of hanging out in there. And there's three things you need to know about Justin. First of all, his mind is razor sharp. I was going to say he's wicked smart, but you might not understand what I mean by that. But, I mean, he's just got a lot going on up in his brain. And he's also got a great sense of humor. I mean, he's just funny. He's got a real dry sense of humor. I really like that. So we get along great. But the third thing is you need to know that he gave me permission to tell this. I just wanted you to know. So Justin was hanging out in my office, and I was working on some things, and he noticed the church newsletter sitting over on my desk, and it was turned to the back page, and he saw the logo that's up on the screen, Call of Duty. And kind of indignantly, he said, Call of Duty? That's a first-person shooter video game. That has nothing to do with church. That shouldn't be in our newsletter. And I said, that's my next sermon series about Jesus. And he said, oh, I'll show myself out. And he turned and he left the office. I'm telling you, I hadn't laughed that hard all week. It was hilarious. It was perfect timing. You know, maybe you kind of felt that way. Maybe when you saw Call of Duty, you said, Call of Duty, that's a violent video game. That has nothing to do with church. Why would we use that kind of imagery to talk about Jesus? Well, there's several reasons. The first is, it's just a hook to get people's attention. The Apostle Paul quoted the poets of his day to build a bridge with his audience. He may not have agreed with the poets, but he used them to build a bridge. Okay? For better or for worse, Call of Duty is one of the most popular video games out, and the logo is pretty recognizable, so I thought that it would be an attention getter. See, you need to understand that sometimes we're going to watch movie clips, or sometimes we're going to listen to songs, and we may not agree with them. In fact, they may be saying exactly the opposite of what we believe. That's kind of the point. It's to kind of understand our culture better. So the illustration shown may not be an endorsement, okay? That makes sense. All right, so that's just part of culture. Now, I would also point out that the term Call of Duty existed long before the game, so we can't let them have it, all right? The reality is Call of Duty is something that's important for all of us. We need to have something that we are called to and that God wants us to do. All right, we need to have something that gives our lives meaning and purpose. And still further, Jesus may not have come with a gun in his hand, but listen, on the cross, he fought the greatest battle that's ever been fought, and he was tough as nails. And so I think the imagery works. And if you don't, we'll see you after Easter. Okay, I'm sorry. But anyway, look. All right, Luke 9:51. This is the theme verse for the entire series. As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. He resolutely set out for Jerusalem. He resolutely set out knowing exactly what he was walking into. Opposition, abuse, torture, and death. You know, sometimes the right thing to do is the hardest thing to do. Would you agree with that? Sometimes the right thing to do is the hardest thing to do. That's what it means to do your duty, and that's exactly what Jesus did for us. So here's what we're going to do for the next couple of months. We're going to walk through the final week of Jesus' earthly ministry, and we're going to do it with Jesus. The first four books of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are known as the Gospels. The word gospel means good news, and those four books tell us the good news about Jesus. They wrote from different perspectives. These four guys wrote to different audiences. But the focal point was all about the impact of Jesus' life on the world. Now, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are very similar in their approach. John does it a little bit differently. And yet, we're going to hear from all four of them at one week or another during this series. Did you realize that one-third of the Gospels is about the final week of Christ's ministry? From the triumphal entry of Palm Sunday to the resurrection of Christ on Easter Sunday, Jesus did a lot of teaching. He did a lot of influencing during those 8 days. He also managed to change the world and rewrite history, so it's kind of a big deal, all right? And that's why so much attention is given to it. We're not going to cover everything that happens during those days, but we're going to see a lot. We're going to learn a lot. Hopefully, we'll change at least a little. Several years ago, I read about a commuter pilot in just a small plane, and they were going along. They hit some really extreme turbulence. Both engines suddenly went out. All of a sudden, the cockpit door flies open. The pilot comes out wearing a parachute. He says, keep calm, everybody. I'm going for help. Okay, yeah. Okay, character is sometimes forged during a crisis, but that is more often revealed during a crisis. Dramatic, emotionally charged experiences give us oftentimes a clearer view of a person's character than we get when everything is just going smooth for them. For instance, you learn more about a person's character when they're losing the ball game than when they're winning the ball game. Which raises the question, why didn't Tom Brady shake Nick Foles' hand after the Super Bowl? But I digress. Anyway, back to the point. Stress reveals character. You get a better glimpse of a person's character when you're in the intensive care waiting room than if you're watching TV in the living room. You learn more about a person's character on the front lines of battle than you would playing cards in the barracks. Stress reveals character. You learn more about your pilot when the engines fail. The more intense the experience, the more intimate the picture that you get. And it does not get any more intense than the final week of Jesus' life, his ministry. There's the triumphant ride into Jerusalem. There's the confrontation in the temple when he threw out those who were doing dishonest business there. On Tuesday, he fielded questions from the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They were his greatest opposition. He did some really profound teaching during those days. The Last Supper with the disciples. There's the arrest in the Garden of Gethsemane. There's the legal corruption that led to his excruciating death and changed the world. He exploded out of the tomb on Easter Sunday. Nothing's ever been the same since. It's the most profound week in history. And we're going to have a front row seat for the next 8 weeks. Now, we begin today with this triumphal entry into Jerusalem. But I want to show you two sides to the event. See, the one that we usually focus on is all about the celebration. But there is another side that we often overlook. For all the excitement of the crowd, Jesus saw through the drama. He cut to the heart of the matter. He has a way of doing that. And this event will set the stage for the glimpses of him that we're going to get throughout the rest of the series. So take a look in Luke chapter 19, beginning on verse 28. After Jesus had said this, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. He had been doing some teaching, so after that, he went on ahead, going to Jerusalem. Verse 29, as he approached Bethphage and Bethany at the hill called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, saying to them, go to the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you'll find a colt tied there, which no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, why are you untying it? Tell him the Lord needs it. Now, Matthew clarifies in his gospel that this was the colt of a donkey. And the disciples did exactly what Jesus said. They went, they got the colt, they also brought its mother along, and as they were untying them, they were asked why they were doing it. They said exactly what Jesus said, the Lord needs it, and the owners gladly shared. This would be like Jesus saying, hey, can I borrow your car? And you're like, heck yeah, Jesus wants to borrow my car. And so they loaned their donkeys to him. Well, it's Sunday, it's the day following the Sabbath. This is the beginning of Passover week. There are thousands of Jews that have converged on Jerusalem. And in the next 5 days, this crowd would be crying for Jesus' blood. But for the moment, he is the focal point of celebration. Why? Because he is riding into Jerusalem in a way that maybe is more profound than you realize. See, you might question the arrival of a king showing up on a donkey. It just doesn't sound very regal. It just seems like maybe he ought to be on a white stallion, or maybe he ought to be on a Roman chariot, you know, something a little more dramatic than a donkey. But the crowd in Jesus' day knew the Old Testament prophecy very well from Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9. It says, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. Jesus was declaring in no uncertain terms that the king had come. And so this is kind of what motivated their outburst in Luke 19, verse 35. It says they threw their cloaks on the colt. They put Jesus on it. And as he went along, people spread their cloaks on the road. When he came near the place where the road goes down the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of disciples began joyfully to praise God in loud voices for all the miracles they had seen. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, they shouted. Peace in heaven, glory in the highest. See, for 3 years, Jesus had been telling his disciples and telling all those who witnessed his miracles to keep quiet about it. He understood that if he stirred up too much attention too soon, the religious leaders would come after him before he was ready for them to. And yet here he is today. He's riding boldly and confidently into Jerusalem. He's intentionally fulfilling a prophecy that had been made hundreds of years before because the time had come. You know, when I was figuring out titles for these messages, I came up with two words for this sermon today, and it's these: man up. Man up. We use that term when we want somebody to step up and be brave and face a tough situation. Kind of like the video, the guy, man up. You know, the standing man. That's what Jesus did. William Barclay wrote this. He said, it's breathtaking to think that a man with a price on his head, an outlaw, is deliberately riding into a city in such a way that everybody can see him. He said, it is impossible to exaggerate the sheer courage of Jesus. And the people saw him, and they're just filled with joy. They're throwing their coats on the ground so he doesn't have to touch the ground. And we read in Matthew and Mark that they cut palm branches and they waved them in the air, and they did a blanket of palm branches on the road as well. That's why we call it Palm Sunday. And the people were kind of going crazy. I mean, Hosanna in the highest. Blessed is the coming kingdom. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Listen, there had not been an outpouring of praise like this since the angels sang glory to God in the highest on the night Jesus was born. 30 years of obscurity in Nazareth, 3 years of traveling here and preaching there and arguing with the Pharisees and trying to avoid too much stress too soon, and the crowd is suddenly today erupting in praise. It's like heaven couldn't wait any longer. Jesus was to be exalted. It's an awesome worship service, but here's the problem. The people did not understand what was going on. See, they thought that Jesus had come to be a political king. They were counting on him overthrowing Rome. They thought that he was going to deliver them from taxes and from oppression. He was going to restore the kingdom to the days like it was back under King David and King Solomon hundreds of years before. They wanted freedom. They wanted deliverance. They wanted prosperity. And they thought Jesus had come for that. They did not understand when he said, "My kingdom is not of this world." And so their celebration was short-lived. Now, you got to understand, while the people are cheering and singing and dancing and having a big time, the religious leaders are standing by, and they're kind of wringing their hands and crossing their arms, you know, and they hate everything that's going on. Luke 19:39, some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples." "I tell you," he replied, "if they keep quiet, the stones will cry out." Jesus is like, "You guys just don't get it. The universe has been waiting since creation for this week. And now it's here. You shut them up, the rocks are going to sing. Or the stones are going to rock. Or however you want to think of it. I'm telling you, the whole world has been waiting for this." I love it. Over in John 12:19, one of the Pharisees whines and says, "The whole world has gone after him." It's like, you know, we can't win. And that's how they felt. They're losing their grip. They don't like it. This was like the only time in Jesus' ministry when he entered Jerusalem as a king, at least as people would have expected a king to come. And yet nobody in the crowd that day understood what kind of king he had come to be. That's why there's another side to Jesus' triumphal entry besides the party. And truthfully, I think it's the more profound side. See, I'm going to show you what it really means to man up. I'm going to show you why it's easy to smile and wave when everybody's cheering and everybody's happy. But when you know the rest of the story, when you know the pain and the heartache that's coming, it's a whole different story. See, it's not all that important that the crowds were excited when Jesus rode into Jerusalem. Crowds are fickle. Parades come and go. But what matters is what happened next. Look at verse 41 in Luke 19. As he approached Jerusalem and he saw the city, Jesus wept over it. You know, it's always a little awkward when somebody cries at a party. You're trying to have a good time and it's just awkward. When I was in high school, we were getting ready to go on a youth group trip for the weekend, some retreat or something. And so there were four of us, my girlfriend from high school and I, and one of my friends from church and his girlfriend. And we've been looking forward to this for weeks. We were going to have a great time together. We were going to hang out. I mean, it's just going to be so fun. We got out of school early on Friday. Everything's going great. We get to church. We're getting ready to load up to go. About 20 minutes in the parking lot, and my friend breaks up with his girlfriend. They had some kind of fight. He's mad all weekend. She cries all weekend. And I gave serious thought to killing him because he had ruined the whole weekend. It's like, come on, are you kidding me? You're supposed to be having a party and somebody's crying all the way through it. It's just kind of awkward. Why was Jesus crying? Was it because he knew what was coming? I mean, in just a few days, they're going to be crying out for my death. Why was he crying? Is it because he knows in just a few days that Judas will betray him, Peter will deny him, the rest of the disciples will forsake him? I mean, why was he crying? Is it because he knows that he's going to bear the sins of the whole world and he knows what it's going to be like on the cross? You know, all of that could have played into his emotion, but the key is that he wasn't crying for himself, he was crying for them. Look at verse 41 again. As he approached Jerusalem and he saw the city, he wept over it, and he said, "If you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it's hidden from your eyes. The days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you, and they will encircle you, and they'll hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you." The people refused to grasp who Jesus was, and they were going to pay for it. Listen, there was not a person in the crowd that day who thought Jesus dying on Friday would have anything to do with their best interest, right? I mean, the friends couldn't bear the thought of him dying. They certainly didn't want that. The enemies didn't think that his death would do anything to benefit them, not in a spiritual sense at all. But Jesus could see the situation for what it really was. He knew how desperate their need was, how devastating the path was that they were on. He wasn't weeping for himself. He was weeping for them. Notice the end of verse 44. He said, "You did not recognize the time of God's coming to you. If only you would have understood who I am." And it was that stubborn, self-inflicted blindness that led to the second reason for his tears. Verse 43, he says to them, "The days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you. They will encircle you. They will hem you in on every side. They'll dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another." And those words came true less than four decades after Jesus' death and resurrection. The Jews revolted against Rome in AD 66, and Titus, who was the son of the emperor Vespasian, not the Titus that's in the New Testament, he was sent to crush the rebellion. In 70 AD, Jerusalem was completely destroyed. Some 600,000 Jews were slaughtered by Titus and his army. And as Jesus looked at the city of God on this particular day that he's riding into Jerusalem, and he's hearing the cries of celebration from the people. You know, he didn't storm the city to destroy Rome, and he didn't, you know, come busting in and gloating over the destruction of Jerusalem that's to come because they didn't recognize who he was. He's weeping because he knows God's punishment is coming. His heart is broken because of the pain and the suffering that they're about to face because of their choices. And it kind of occurs to me, it's a brave man who weeps for others when his own life is about to be destroyed. And there's something really courageous about that. Can you imagine? Jesus is focusing not on his own grief and pain for what's about to happen to him, but he's seeing their struggles and their pain. And so I want to kind of turn a corner here and help you understand what I think is the most profound part of the triumphal entry, and that's the compassion of Jesus. The compassion of Christ to see what was going on here. Listen, compassion is more than a feeling. It's not an emotion, it's an action. Right? Feelings don't really mean very much. If I feel bad for hurting your feelings, but I never apologize to you, my feelings haven't done anything to make the situation better. If I feel like I ought to go to the doctor, but I don't go, well, my feelings haven't done anything to get me any medicine. Right? If I feel grateful, but I never proclaim to the Lord that I'm grateful, or I never live a grateful life, my feelings don't really do very much. So let me just give you some quick definitions when we think about compassion. The first thing is sympathy. Sympathy is sort of the first level. It's when I feel sorry for you. You know, I'm sorry that you're going through whatever. I sympathize with your hurts. But you know what? Feelings come and go pretty quickly, and sympathy really doesn't help anybody much in the long run. But next, there's empathy. This is sort of another step above sympathy. And this is when you identify with somebody else's pain. You put yourself in their place. You see things from their perspective. Think about it like this. What's it like to be in seventh grade? Do you remember how hard that was? What's it like to be new in town? What's it like to walk into a church for the very first time? What's it like to not have red hair? I mean, I just can't even imagine what you guys are going through. What's it like to battle an addiction? What's it like to grow up in an abusive home? What's it like to live in America and not speak English? What's it like to bury your child? What's it like to be alone? Most of us have no idea what the rest of us are going through. Native Americans used to talk about walking a mile in another person's moccasins. In other words, empathy. It's broadening our thinking to consider not just, oh, I'm sorry you're going through that, but what would it be like? What would it feel like to be going through whatever it is you're going through? That's what Jesus did. But listen, empathy alone is still not enough. Philip Yancey said, a bleeding heart doesn't do any good if it bleeds to death. We need to do more than feel sorry for somebody or even feel their pain. We have to do something about it. That's true compassion. It's action. See, one of the great things about going on a mission trip or even having the guts to walk across the street and meet your new neighbors is that you're doing something tangible. You are, in an active way, setting yourself up to offer some friendship or support. If you want to have a friend, you got to be a friend. There's some action there. If you want to be understood, you need to be understanding. If you want people to show you compassion, you need to be compassionate. You know, I was listening to public radio this week, and I heard that John Perry Barlow died. Now, Barlow was a cattle rancher in Wyoming. He was kind of an internet pioneer. He was an American poet. He actually wrote lyrics to several Grateful Dead songs. I was never a Deadhead, so I couldn't tell you which songs they were. But back in the 70s, Barlow wrote a list of 25 rules for being grown up. And they talked about it on the radio, so I looked it up. I wanted to see what they were. And here were some of his rules for being grown up. He said, say nothing of another that you would not say to him. Concern yourself with what is right, not who is right. Love forgives everything. Avoid the pursuit of happiness. Seek to define your mission and pursue that. Become less suspicious of joy. Foster dignity. Live memorably. Endure. And then he said, learn the needs of those around you and respect them. You know, I read his list, and there's lots more to it than just that. It's about loving people and forgiving people and respecting people. And I thought, this list is about compassion. This list is about not just feeling sorry for somebody, not just trying to identify with their hurts, but actually doing something with them and in them and living life with them. Jesus wept over Jerusalem because of what was about to come. He saw their failure and it broke his heart. I remember back in 2008, I got to go with a group of pastors on a trip to Israel. And on a hill overlooking Jerusalem, we visited a church called the Sanctuary of the Dominus Flavit. The church was built along the path where they think the triumphal entry may have happened. And we picture the excitement of Palm Sunday and the triumphal entry and the palm branches and the singing and the dancing and all that. Good Friday is still 5 days away. This is celebration time. This is party time. But Jesus cried, like we said, on Palm Sunday. The Sanctuary of the Dominus Flavit does not commemorate the triumphal entry. The Latin phrase Dominus Flavit actually means the Lord wept. That church was built to honor the place or somewhere near it where Jesus cried about Jerusalem. He knows the pain that's coming. He knows the devastation, and he weeps. On the altar of the church there in Jerusalem, there's a mosaic of a hen spreading her wings around her chicks. And it's in reference to Matthew 23. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I long to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. And you just hear the empathy in Jesus' voice as he weeps. But friends, listen, if all Jesus did was cry about Jerusalem, we would not still be meeting every Sunday in his honor. I mean, if he just shed a few tears about what was going to happen to them, that really wouldn't have meant very much. It's what Jesus did on Good Friday. It's what he did on Easter Sunday. That's what makes his compassion so powerful. He went beyond empathy. He did something about it. He didn't just feel sorry for us. He fixed the problem. As the old song says, he lived and died to buy my pardon. Compassion is more than a feeling. It's an action. I mean, think about this. When you see someone who's coming to church and they look kind of like a deer in the headlights because they're not sure where they're supposed to be, or maybe you're in the youth group and there's a kid sitting by themselves and nobody else is sitting with them, see, what compassion does is it builds a bridge, not a wall. When you see somebody that's sick or they're going through a hard time, you know, compassion fixes a meal or makes a visit or sends a card. It doesn't just kind of, boy, I'm sorry they're sick. Hope everything works out all right. When a person from another race or another religion moves in across the street, compassion walks across the street and says hello. When somebody's hungry or homeless, somebody's working through an addiction, they're living a life that's far from God, compassion looks for ways to break down barriers and to make a difference, invest in somebody's life. Now, it takes discernment to do this, right? It's one of the profound, poignant things about the triumphal entry. Jesus saw this joyful crowd, and he had the ability, the discernment, to look past all this external facade and to see the tragedy that was coming. Sometimes we look at people, and we're not quite sure how to discern the situation. Is their need legitimate? What's the best way that I can help? If I get involved, will I be helping them, hurting them, enabling them? Is there somebody else I should connect them with who could help them better than I can? And then the most important question of all, what would Jesus do? And I don't mean flippantly like, oh, WWJD. I'm talking about seriously. If Jesus was right here right now and they were right here right now, what would he do? And trying to figure that out. I mean, wouldn't it be awesome if we could see people with the same clarity that Jesus sees people? Wouldn't it be awesome if we could see Jesus with the same clarity that he sees us? See, compassion means that we see people through the lens of Jesus. That's kind of the bottom line today, is that compassion means we see people through the lens of Jesus. We see them, we see God, we see ourselves by looking through the eyes of Christ. Compassion, I think, is the most profound thing that happened on the day of the triumphal entry. His tears meant more than their celebration. And it tells us something about our duty. You know, when I was preaching at Fern Creek Christian Church years ago, Ron Castens was on staff at Northeast Christian Church, and he and I led several weeks of church camp together, high school weeks of church camp, at White Mills Christian Camp. One of those weeks stands out to me as the most profound week of camp I was ever a part of, and truthfully, one of the most spiritually impacting weeks of my life. And I got to be honest with you, most of the time faculty at camp wouldn't say it was the highlight of their lives, you know, but I'm telling you, this week was different. We used that week to focus on the final week of Christ's earthly ministry, kind of like what we're doing during this series. And a guy named Doug Henderson, we had asked him to come spend the week with us. He taught special effects at the Art Institute of Pittsburgh. I mean, he was an incredible artist, a dynamic Christian. He was a great actor, and he happened to have kind of dark skin and long dark hair. And, he could play Jesus spot on. Well, most of the time, I mean, Doug was clean-shaven. He'd pull his hair back in a ponytail, and that's how he looked during camp, except for one time each day, he would meticulously put a beard on that I'm telling you could be right in front of him, and it looked real. That's what he taught special effects. He was amazing. And he would let his hair down, he put on a robe and sandals, and he would in some way interact. It might be for 5 minutes, it might be for a couple hours, but every day he was there at the camp that week. It was opening day, Sunday evening. We're in the open-air chapel, and we're worshiping, and all of a sudden, somebody ran in and shouted, "Look, he's coming." And we looked out across the camp, and here came Jesus riding in on a horse. And you're saying, it's supposed to be a donkey. The only donkey we could find in White Mills had never been ridden before, and we thought if he got bucked off and trampled, we would scar kids for life. So we did not put him on a donkey. Okay, I'm sorry, it was a horse. Sorry. It was amazing. The sun was setting, and he comes right. I can just picture it in my mind. And everybody ran out to see him. And my friend Phil Miller was there that week, and his daughter Emily was there. And Emily's grown and married now, but she was about 5 years old. And she saw him and she said, "Mommy, did Jesus really come to see us?" And Marcia didn't answer. She just said, "You want to go see him?" And Emily said, "Yes, she did." And she walked up to him. I don't think she was breathing. Her eyes were as big as saucers. And she looked up at him and he smiled at her and he leaned down and gave her a kiss on the cheek. She was convinced that Jesus had just kissed her. It was beautiful. And there were other interactions that week, and I'm going to tell you about some of them during this series because it was so profound. But I don't think anything was more beautiful than that one. "Behold, your king comes to you gentle and riding on a donkey." Your king comes to you. And he's a victorious king, and he's a loving king, and he's a gentle king, and he is a compassionate king. And so we pray, Lord, help us to look through the lens of Jesus. Help us to see people like he did. That's our duty, the compassion of Christ.